Hey, brothers and sisters, welcome to Taking It Down. I'm going to be with you in just a second, but here's a note from our friends, whom I know many of you will enjoy over at Polyphonic Press.
Hey, this is Jeremy from Polyphonic Press. Along with my co-host and best friend, John Van Dyke, we are exploring classic albums completely at random. At the top of each show, we have no idea what album we're going to be listening to. We have the patented random album generator to give us an album. Sometimes it's an album we're very familiar with, and sometimes it's an artist we have never heard of. Either way, it gives us a chance to really listen to these classic releases, and gives us insights that we may never have thought of before.
For something to come out of them.
Agreed.
Maybe he needed the other Beatles in the room at that time.
Well, I think so, and I think if you watch that Peter Jackson documentary from a few years ago about the Let It Be sessions, I think, you know, it was kind of, the writing was on the wall. I mean, they were breaking up.
John Lennon didn't sign the papers to officially dissolve the Beatles until 1974.
So if this sounds interesting, be sure to follow Polyphonic Press on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, and everywhere else podcasts are available. We upload every Tuesday morning, and we strongly encourage you to listen along with us. Cheers.
All right, how's it going? Our episode today is also sponsored by Kodachrome Gardens in Florence, Alabama. Look, you want your produce fresh, you want to know where it comes from, and you want it affordable. You get all that at Kodachrome Gardens. Go to the Quad City area, go to Florence Saturdays, and get yourself all you need, as well as a shirt or two, and support that incredible endeavor of urban farming. We don't see it everywhere. It's really cool. That's Kodachrome Gardens. Follow them on Instagram, and you can keep up with when and where they have things going on, as well as sign up for their newsletter, which you'll find there in their Instagram feed. Yeah, so still trying on this new shirt of formatting the podcast. I'm liking it. You guys like it? Talk to me. You can talk out loud. No one can hear you. I can hear you. Oh, what's going on? We've got Taking It Down on video Wednesday evenings, 5:30. You can watch it anytime, but that's when they premiere. Fun bit of segments coming up on Taking It Down on video the next few weeks. We're going to tackle Twin Peaks and its relevance, its importance, its influence, and just where we were when we saw it. That's going to be me and Raz on Taking It Down on video. Join us. You know, I've still been watching The Gentlemen on Netflix. That's going to appeal to a lot of you. I'm still on board with it because it's so entertaining. Entertaining's all you can ask for, I think, especially with Netflix. That's what you want. Continuing with TV, I've got some spoiler-free thoughts on two shows early in their runs. Friends, if you're able to withstand sloppy dialogue, a miscast actor or two, or unnecessary and oft-times jarring time jumps, then Manhunt on Apple TV will do for you, especially if you need some historical recounting in your life. The series is based on the work of James L. Swanson, not to be confused with Ron, who wrote about the work it took to track down John Wilkes Booth. Now, if you're like me, and you know the assassination of Lincoln, and maybe little else that followed, including the idea that President Johnson, who followed, was a Southerner who was soon impeached, though saved by one Senate vote. If that's the kind of thing you didn't know about, or you're interested in seeing on screen, then, you know, this series will work. It does shine a lot of contextual light to the aftermath of Lincoln's assassination. Usually the history books just tell you that and put a period on and next chapter. But damn if it doesn't feel like a really expensive, really nice 1985 ABC miniseries, with all the good and the bad that entails. Manhunt really makes me miss shows like Deadwood, where craft and manner was taken into the making of it, especially in an attempt to separate the dialogue from our modern lingo. At times it feels like this show wasn't taken as seriously as it could have been because of the diction of these characters. It just doesn't. It feels incongruent. And then, especially in the first episode, there's this question that hovers above it on what sort of show it even wants to be. Does it want to be a procedural, a mystery? Are we supposed to pull for John Wilkes Booth? I think that settles down in the second episode some. However, there's good acting. There's perfect, just delicious set designs. And kudos for it to for the show of just sitting you right down in the fray and reminding you of the story after the story. Being a Southerner, I always wonder what the population was thinking individually on a more microscopic level during the Civil War. I really wish Manhunt could get into that. We get small, small glimpses of it here and there. Definitely something I'd like to see portrayed on screen. You take for granted from history books and your broad knowledge of what happened that, well, once the Civil War ended, that was that. We wiped our hands clean and went on about our day. Reconstruction began and there were problems there. Jim Crow laws were implemented, so we shifted to a new set of problems, but not quite. I appreciate Manhunt bringing that to my attention. I also started the Netflix show Three Body Problem, perhaps best known as the follow-up for Benioff and Weiss. You know their names from being the head writers and showrunners for the Game of Thrones there. Three Body Problem is based off a Chinese author's trilogy where he blends some sci-fi with the very real cultural revolution of the 1960s China and more. There's more going on than just those things, but I don't want to spoil anything. I've got the first episode under my belt, and as interesting as it gets with the first episode, I hope that we may cover it here on the near future because it is that intriguing. Once again, with this series in particular, I bemoan Netflix's content-first strategy of just dropping every episode of the series all at once. What a waste to do that. Even the showrunners seem to recognize the idiocy of that as they acknowledge it with a trailer at the end of the opening episode. You'd never see that with Netflix where they say, this season on, blah, blah, blah. And they do it here. They realize that, very intelligently realize that people don't watch 8 episodes in one sitting. No one does that. I think that's an urban legend. Who the hell has that much time? No one does that. Don't give me all 8 episodes. I don't want that. It takes away from the significance of episodes when you do that. Each episode has a story to tell within itself. That's just where Netflix has faltered so horribly. It's just content instead of quality. And what a shame. Benioff and Weiss know what to do with books that seem really hard to film and put on screen. From my understanding, this series of books is supposed to be pretty rough as far as trying to get it on screen. There were a couple of odd character relationships, I think, but otherwise, I'm really interested to continue this one. Again, we might mention it on the show in the future. Yeah, so there you are. Let's get into this week's episode.
An elevator take projection.
We're sort of kicking it old school. I'd be curious amongst our devoted fan base of hundreds of thousands, go back that far where it was just me and Adam.
This is it.
It's just me and you today.
We're back. Back where it all started. Probably where it'll end for us.
No, Donovan. He's still out gallivanting across New England. I think he's hanging out with the Yale basketball team. Am I right about that?
That sounds right.
Natalie tendered her resignation last night, which is not quite true. She said she would join us.
She's stepping back to a part-time status, I think.
Yeah, she's going back to part-time. She said she really wants in on some challenge talk and probably some other things. She'll get roped in. So hello to everyone. We're here, and our focus is going to continue to be the FX Hulu show, Shogun, which is worth it. We determined that last week. We won't spoil a thing until we get past our short talk on this set of questions. Do we recommend it? Do we recommend it with any qualifications, or is it a hell no completely? Last week, Adam and Natalie and I answered this. We thoroughly recommended it. Are there any amends you want to make to that, or anything that's no spoilers that you feel like listeners would want to know about Shogun?
Pretty much everything we said last week continues to hold up. It's just a very good, interesting atmosphere, great character driven drama. They're going to wave some swords around. It's going to be great.
Not going to recant your recommendation,
no,
man.
No.
Wonderful. Me either. In fact, I'm falling more in love with this show week by week. If you haven't started watching it, I say watch it. I really do think it might end up being one of the best shows of the year. You never know in March, but it could be.
I think they start. Are there larger trends to TV, like when the prestige shows come out?
This year's going to be weird, but because of the strike.
Right. But do they, I wonder if they sit around and think, well, people are more likely to be inside January, February, March in a lot of the country still isn't spring quite yet. So let's roll some of these guys out, because it seems like there's a lot of stuff that we really enjoy that starts the year. As I'm thinking back to, as you said, it just being the two of us, there's some heavy hitters put out in the first part of the year, generally.
True Detective.
Yeah.
Which we covered. And, you know, that was the way of TV when we grew up. And that's something we covered on Taking It Down on Video last Wednesday with Raz, which is TV used to be three or four channels, and you watched from September to May.
The school year, basically, yeah.
Your school year. That's exactly what it followed, oddly enough, because that's when you're the home the most. You're not going to be home much in summer. You're taking your vacation. So they have to run the reruns then. Yeah, exactly. So I don't know if it follows that specific of a trend, but you may be onto something there.
Well, and now we have the new Game of Thrones coming out. They announced the release date, right? Is mid-June, June 15th, 16th, something like that?
June something, you're right.
But that would be arguably the biggest water cooler show of the year, at least based on track record, and they're just putting it right in the middle of what would have been No Man's Land.
HBO don't give an F.
No. And like you said, the strike, possibly not a normal year.
It's true. Well, we'll unpack this fifth episode of the series Shogun, titled Broken to the Fist. This is your spoiler warning. Thanks for joining us. Continue with us if you've seen Broken to the Fist, the fifth episode of Shogun. In it, the action of an oncoming war, inevitable war. It's because of the repercussions of Toranaga's son's use of the cannons on Jozen, killing him brutally. But that oncoming war is going to be a little slower than I expected. We're going to focus a lot more on the return of the Invincible Warrior and the drama with the Anjin's house, especially when it comes to a dead bird. One thing that makes an excellent series to me is when an episode maintains the narrative and theme of an entire arc of the entire 10 episodes, and yet each episode in and of itself has a story and an individual theme to share or to discuss or analyze. This week I really question, at what point do we tolerate the customs of our neighbors if those customs turn out to be morally repugnant to us?
And this is the first episode that seems to happen in a space that allows for that kind of discussion. It's been so, and this is not a knock against the show at all, it's been moving at such a clip. The scenery has been changing, and we've been getting to know people, and it's a big world. This one was kind of a set piece episode.
Yeah.
You know, you have his house, you have a few other locations around this village that all the action takes place in, and it allows for, with characters that we now know better, that kind of discussion.
Well, let's back it up. We'll kind of go in chronological order, in a way. So early in the episode, we get word that Lady Ochiba is being returned to Osaka, and the Council of Regents meet again to determine what to do about Toranaga's impeachment, because they're down a man now. All right, there's this detail of the regents trying to determine whom to elect to replace the retired, that probably isn't the right word, Toranaga. I'll admit, that seems like a minor difficulty considering how easy it is that they find to say, hey, this guy or gal needs to die, or they don't really want to adhere to the rules of the deceased leader anyway. So I find it odd that they're just like really sticking to this. I was surprised they don't say, let's just do it with four. Leapfrog the idea that there aren't five of them.
I wonder if it's that if someone is in a position above them, like their deceased leader would have been, they are extremely strict in following that, but then kind of dismissive of life below them.
I gotcha.
If that makes sense.
And this episode does a good job of painting the picture of them being adherents to rules and customs, honestly. So I really should take that back.
Right, but it is funny that he's able to, if not checkmate, at least put them in check and force them into a reactive position by just resigning. He's a guy that they really want him dead, but he's been clever and outmaneuvered him through this. Like, I agree with what you're saying. It does seem like a very silly thing, and they all seem frustrated by the custom but are refusing to break it.
Yeah. While awaiting this war to erupt, there's a smaller war contained in the house of the Anjin. That's almost all he was called in this episode. He wasn't John Blackthorne at all. Our Englishman is who I'm talking about. It's a war in his home with multiple sides. About four-sided war there. You know, I question why in the hell he hung a pheasant outdoors for so long, but apparently... Did you research this, by the way?
I did.
I did,
and
too.
If you have read anyone talk about how... Or their memories from reading the book, which neither of us have done, but...
Right.
Apparently this scene in the book is like laugh out loud kind of material.
It kind of was here at times.
Oh, yeah. Played. It, I think this is a funnier... Natalie said this last week that it's possible this would be funnier if you could speak Japanese, but it's already pretty funny given the subject matter.
Yeah. It's got its moments. Blackthorn's reaction to being excited about hanging a dead bird outside and telling them, you know, if you touch it, you'll die in his broken Japanese. And he was just smiling and like, oh, it's going to be so good. And not realizing he was putting a death sentence on someone.
I mean, do we want to get into that?
We will. Just to add to what I was going to say, apparently many cookbooks from years ago recommend hanging such birds in the open air with their feathers intact for 7 to 10 days.
Like 7 to 10 days.
This is true. Apparently some oils build up and make the bird very tender, and the air's got to be around the 50 to 55 degree mark. So you can't just do it in Arizona, okay?
Right.
That would be horrible. But yeah, I think it's right.
I've got this Esquire article picked up.
Did they mention it?
Well, they say, according to Field and Stream,
right,
it's normal to let pheasants mature untouched for a couple days in conditions of 40 to 50 degrees Fahrenheit.
That's about right. Yeah, that's what I read. And they said up to 7 to 10 can even be fine, which blows my mind. That sounds disgusting.
That's just like a putrefaction process, right?
Yeah. Well, there's like a, yes, it's rigor mortis is involved, and there's oils that just make the bird less gamey, apparently. It's supposed to make it good.
I'll let you discover that.
No, I won't.
I'll read the book if you eat the week-old pheasant. How about that?
I want to read the book now.
I do too.
My father-in-law was talking to me yesterday about it, and he said the book's fantastic.
Have you encountered anyone who read the books and was excited to watch it originally? Anybody of that age?
Yeah, my father-in-law.
The 80? Yeah, he had read it before.
He had read the book. Mm-hmm. He had read the book, was so excited about the miniseries, and he thought it was really good. And he said there's a couple of actors in it that just are excellent. The Toranaga guy in the original miniseries is supposed to be good.
Well, he's like a Kurosawa mainstay.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He's one of the greatest Japanese actors of his generation.
Yeah, now he's watching this week to week, and my father-in-law is one of these guys who tends to let episodes build up so he can just kind of, he just wants to watch them night after night.
But he's in.
Yeah, he's in on this. Speaking of funny, though, the shift from funny to like intriguing to then just terrifying between Blackthorn and Buntaro, the returned husband, the great warrior. When you see Blackthorn drink that entire cup of sake, and you wonder if her husband's going to match him, or is he going to be, is his liver as strong enough as Blackthorn's? And then you get the look on the faces of Makiro and Fuji as the Anjin pours the drink. That just added to the humor, but there was just such a subtle and gentle shift into, oh shit.
Yeah, terrifying.
Yeah, when he breezes the damn arrow by his wife's head, not once but twice.
I think we've all, unfortunately, been around people who were had possibly overindulged, and you're a little afraid of what they might do.
Would you like to hear my best story on that topic?
Yeah, sure, why not?
Yep. Raz and I, Raz, co-host of Taking It Down on Video, Raz and I were in a very, it's not even, you can't say dive bar, it's a beer joint, a straight-up beer joint in the backwoods of Mississippi. We were in there in the middle of the day having a couple of beers, shooting some pool, and a guy comes in totally methed out, completely methed out. And he goes out to his truck and comes back in with a gun, a fucking rifle. And the bartender is not the owner, who's usually in charge, but it's a lady. She's like, you can't bring that in here. And Raz looks at me and he goes, we about to go. I was like, yeah, we're leaving. We're not getting shot in this fucking beer joint. He wanted to clean his gun there at the beer joint. But
no.
Yeah. So very much a kind of a moment like that. But yeah, he's fucking firing arrows right beside his wife's nose.
Well, and the whole time I'm thinking, all of the Japanese in this program so far have been shown to be very impressive individuals.
Yes.
You've seen their prowess as warriors and their society, their culture. They're building a city like Osaka that blows the Europeans' minds. When they started drinking, I thought, now, here's a thing that the British can put their stamp on. That
I thought
perhaps,
so, too.
Yeah, and when you realize how deep the training goes, that he's able to put that arrow through the same hole twice, despite not being able to stand up, it's just kind of terrifying.
Yeah, that's some Hawkeye shit.
Yeah.
The episode serves as a major maturation set of days for Blackthorne. He really learns a lot about the culture, even more so.
Using more of the language, scene to scene.
I like that. I really like that a lot. Shogun's done not just an incredible job of world building, but also creating and developing characters you just have these genuine interest and care for, which is what's happening with me and Blackthorne and Mark Hero. And that, to me, is where it warrants the Game of Thrones comparisons that were being tossed about willy-nilly early. It's these characters you're like, I want this person to succeed. I want them to do well.
Right, and they have done a similar thing where they show the tip of the iceberg on a character history.
Yes.
So you're getting just enough to infer a lot, be it, you know, why is Blackthorne really there? What's going on with his two kids? How does he really feel about Protestant versus Catholic? All this kind of stuff that you're just kind of seeing on the surface level, but then all of the representatives of shamed families that he's meeting, that seems to be something that comes up again and again, and the layers are slowly being pulled out on that. I thought the conclusion, not to jump ahead too much, but the marrying that idea with the fascination with rules and order and ceremony at the end where he gives Torunaga the two swords was such a good... Because Torunaga seems to be... I can't even fully take credit for this idea. I did the Reddit dive, but somebody pointed out that he seems to skirt and flout and not be totally sold on how important, or at least be aware of how ridiculous some of the ceremony can be.
Yeah.
He understands why Blackthorne is upset that the gardener was killed because of this, even though he kind of dismisses him and says, I can't listen to this right now.
He gives the American version of, I can't right now.
Yeah. He knows, it's this funny meeting of like both the ceremony and the fact that he knows that the swords that he's given are kind of full of shit.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it's the first time he breaks his facade.
But he takes them because he realizes... Blackthorne is kind of a mirror held up to the society that he's living in. And it's just really nice scene where there's a lot going on. And people had different opinions about what was going on in that scene. But I really enjoyed that read of Torunaga just embracing his view of the absurdity of what he's living in.
So what are two interpretations of that scene then?
I mean, another one could be just as simple as this European doesn't understand what he's doing.
Okay.
You know, and just kind of laughing at that, and no one knows if they should take it seriously or not because of the implications, not just of the swords themselves, but a man disarming himself for someone else. You know, there's so many things that he may just not comprehend that he's doing that would be worth a chuckle versus, I think this is a good guy that I am building a relationship with. And back to that mirror idea of, I'm kind of laughing at like, he just likes me and wants to, you know, he's also the first one down the hill, Blackthorne is.
Yes.
Where you see, I mean, it kind of is a mirror image of the first episode where, I'm going to forget his name, when he falls off the cliff.
Right.
And he's just ready to accept death on the waves.
Oh, yeah, yeah. This has been established with Blackthorne. He's not the type to leave a man behind because even when Mark Hero's husband was left ashore, he couldn't believe, we're just rowing away.
Right. I mean, I suppose the dignified thing would have been to not fight out of that rubble if you're Torunaga, and for him to just refuse and to jump down and pull him out. The ultimate leader is without his swords and buried in mud.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a good scene. There's a lot going on that I didn't really consider at first.
The interpretation of Torunaga laughing or smiling because this poor Englishman has no idea what he's doing. That's kind of sad. It makes you feel sorry for the Anjin.
Well, I don't know that he doesn't know what he's doing in a he's embarrassed himself kind of way. He's doing the decent thing, and I understand that, but he doesn't know how many cultural lines he's crossing.
Mm-hmm.
and kind of laughing at that.
Yeah.
I'd like that better than he doesn't know that he's giving me meaningless swords and I'm too important to carry these.
I kind of like that. It causes him to chuckle.
Yeah.
And speaking of the earthquake, though, that was a well-done earthquake scene.
It was incredible.
It seemed realistic. I've never been involved with an earthquake, but it seemed better than just having the cameras move.
Shake. Yeah. Shake. When one of the FX workers weighs in on a scene, that's pretty cool. And one of the guys who had worked on that gave a rundown of how they did it. And then one of the sound designers also popped in and said, this is how we kind of supplemented what they had done visually. Hmm. And apparently it seemed to me pretty fantastical. Apparently that's a realistic depiction of what that would look like,
which is scary.
Yeah. I'm going to use the word terrifying for, I think, the third time this episode. Yeah.
Some smaller plots revolve around Yabushige, continued search for Toranaga's spy and whether his devotion lies fully with Toranaga or perhaps Ishido back at the castle in Osaka.
That was a good reveal that the spy was an undercover samurai.
Ah, yeah, it was.
The humble villager.
It was almost a toss-away line.
I liked the comes from samurai movies, but it seems like almost like a, Obi-Wan in the desert kind of Jedi undercover kind of trope.
Mm-hmm. Makes you wonder if that guy's going to yank a sword and slash someone.
Like at a crucial moment where you think all hope is lost and, oh, wait, secret samurai.
Yeah. I asked everyone last week what we thought Toranaga was up to at his castle or home of Ito, and it was raising that huge army and apparently releasing the mother to the heir, Lady Ochaba, who was under Toranaga's care, as he put it. She's been returned to the palace by the end of the episode.
And it's just completely terrifying. Again, I'm going to use it the fourth time.
Well, I'll tell you something that really helped that scene, and I thought about this, because I just noticed it this episode. The sound design is from Atticus Ross, famous, guy. And that's when I felt it the most.
Mm-hmm. The menace?
Yeah. Yeah, she's the mother to the heir of Japan. Her importance hasn't really been laid bare as of yet. Until she rolls in, stomps Ichido's nuts, and tell him she's there to control.
She's the first one to go full circle who doesn't really seem to give a shit about what the deceased wanted. You know, she's not beholden to these five dudes.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
like an out-and-out power grab, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Some Cersei vibes.
Right.
Game of Thrones. That has to spell worse trouble for Toranaga, or else the drama's a bit at ease, but I don't, it's going to be interesting how so.
Well, they keep dividing those regents in ways that are unexpected.
Uh-huh.
It seems like the more division Ishido faces, the better off for Toranaga, right? Because if he's the lone wolf, more or less, at this point. So if there's this rogue queen, for lack of a better word, that has to help him, right?
Yes. I'm also curious as to how Ishido doesn't want to pair with Toranaga because they're both anti-Christian.
Right.
And the other regions are in the Christian camp, I think. All the rest of the three, or at least two of them.
Well, Ishido seems to be weighing his options at all times. Mm-hmm. Like, he's the leader of the other, the non-Toranaga four, but it's kind of crumbling in his hands.
Right.
And he seems to know that Toranaga is, you don't really want to mess with him.
He gets it. He gets the severity of the situation. And the complexity continues because he is Yashibushi, I'm butchering his poor name, but is he, that particular lord, is he loyal to Toranaga or to Ishido? And does Toranaga really believe that Omi was just as smart as he is? Omi being the young nephew in charge of the fishing village.
Yashibushi. Returning again to comedy, he is a very funny character to me.
He is
and
so funny.
The actor seems to be having a real blast playing this kind of like heel of a guy in some ways, but also like the fool,
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. He's such a heel.
And this is kind of like again, the internet helped me connect these dots, but One actually Japanese viewer said this is kind of a classic comedic character in Japanese cinema, and it's definitely in some Kurosawa stuff where, like, the borderline meathead kind of dummy who's trying to play a few different people, but it's not, like, it's very easy to see what's going on, and he is easily struck down, like, when he tries to blame the nephew, like you were saying, and the nephew ends up getting rewarded mm-hmm. as a result of it.
Yeah. Toranaga's like, no, that's what I want.
Yeah, it's fun. It's a good time.
Where are you with Cosmos Jarvis as John Blackthorne, the Anjin? Because I asked this, I've seen a little bit of various folks online who think he's a bad actor, that he's overdoing it with the same facial expressions and shouting his lines. And I have a response to that, but I want to hear what you say.
When you said, what is your feeling about him? I was going to say, I think he overacted early. I think episode one, I was kind of, his first, I don't know, half hour on screen, I was kind of rolling my eyes thinking, if this is a guy who's going to play like this, and I'm watching people speak a language I don't know, are they doing the same thing? You know, like, what is the quality of the acting in this? But he's softened a lot post-haircut and as he settled in. But I mean, he is, to put it in guitar terms, he's got it turned to 10 most of the time. He's going for it.
Well, he's not an actor. I don't think that's his day job. I think he's a musician. But to me, he's great. And that may be because he's coming across as not actorly, especially in a society where everyone is an actor and carefully choosing their own words. And he's just, like, overdoing it. I think that's probably why he was cast. If he's making the choices to do that, I think it's great.
The character is written in such a way that he seems to be, like, trying for almost like a pirate kind of thing early on. But then when he does pull off, like, the boat race kind of scene, you're like, well, this guy's putting his money where his very loud mouth is. So it kind of works. And I thought that he handled all of the nuance happening in this most recent episode,
right,
really well. Everything from the confrontation with the no death that doesn't happen off screen, or a death that doesn't happen off screen is not a death, husband. Mm-hmm. What's his name that comes back? The
Buntaro or something like that? Well, that's his nickname. He doesn't allow people to call him.
It's, yeah, that was good too, to show how stiff that guy is.
Yeah.
But I thought their interaction was, like we said, very high stakes and very well acted. And the switch from, like, his playful, no one touches the pheasant, to what the hell is wrong with you people, just horrified over the course of the episode, was well done, I thought. That's a range that wasn't there for him in the first one.
Yes, which leads me to one of my final questions. You want to comment on Markiro's backstory, how she's from a dishonored family and should have died with him, but she didn't because she was married, and now she isn't allowed to die so as to remember her family's dishonor? That's some layered punishment.
And she's ordered to live by her husband.
Yeah, he doesn't let her.
Her annual tradition is asking permission to die, to which he says no.
And it's only one line, but in the previous episode, episode 4, Toranaga tells her she can do what she's been asking to do if she'll serve him. So
I didn't
now we know
that.
What that is. Yeah, well, I did a little digging and discovered that it's a sad moment when you realize that he's going to grant that in episode 4, assuming he keeps his promise and she still wants to, I guess.
And it makes you, as you think back to things that she said or been an audience to all of Blackthorne, his musings at best and rantings at worst about the value of life, the value given to life in Japan, and how he doesn't understand that. That must be feel very personal to her, that here's a guy who would survive no matter what, and she's attempting to end this embarrassment. He may be offering a different vision of what life or redemption or any of these things, which is funny that she's the one wearing the cross at all times. Of all people, she should understand mercy and second chances. Apparently not. Yeah, both the women in his immediate orbit are dealing with some heavy, heavy stuff. I mean, is it Fuji?
Yeah, Fuji.
The other, yeah, is kind of only left alive to deal with the shame, right?
That's right.
That's like her punishment. Yeah.
Yes. I was worried she was going to be dead or really injured and die in the next episode when he returns from the earthquake.
No, she would have just shot the earthquake.
Oh, Fuji would have?
Yeah, she's pretty quick with that gun.
Yeah, she's getting better. Were you hoping Blackthorn was going to shoot the husband?
I thought it would have been kind of cool in like a Indiana Jones dude waves the sword around kind of way.
Yeah.
But I'm glad that he didn't.
Yeah, he had restraint.
It could have been taken down to the level of that Indiana Jones scene for sure, but it's better that, and I would still like to know if Blackthorn understood what the guy said when he, at the height of their confrontation, he apologized, right?
Yeah, well, he's blaming the sake. Mm-hmm. Well, he picked up on that.
But it was a deeper, to me, it wasn't just like, sorry, I'm drunk. It was more to it.
Yeah, I don't think he got the depth. He understood the sake, which he wasn't on board with as an excuse.
No, he was ready for round 14 or whatever they were at.
He was passed out face first on the floor. How many times have you done that?
Well, they sleep on the floor, Blaine.
Too many to count? You don't sleep on the floor. Oh, no, I'm talking about you. How many times have you passed out face first on the floor? For Adam, for Donovan, for Natalie, I'm Blaine. And that's going to lead us to the end of the episode. Talk to us. Let us know what you think. Find us online. We're easy to find. We're all over social media, and we respond. Final thoughts?
This has turned into we played catch up, but now this is a weekly viewer, like night of or night after. So this is such a joy when a program is like that. It's usually a Sunday night HBO show, but I like a little midweek pick-me-up, too.
FX coming in hot, trying to pick up some of HBO's slack, maybe take their title, which we thought Apple was going to be the one to do that, but maybe not.
I'm out on Apple until they give me Severance Season 2.
What about Franklin? You're not interested in Benjamin Franklin's antics?
Our horniest almost president?
That's it.
Yeah. I didn't know that they were doing such a thing. All right, I'm in.
All right. That's it for us. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to everyone next Tuesday.